NTU World of Wisdom. Welcome to High Impact Thesis. In this podcast, we speak with researchers from various scientific fields to talk about the motivation, goal, and potential impact of their research. We also want to give you a sense of how a PhD is carried out with an emphasis on the PH, the philosophical aspects involved in pursuing a PhD. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the High Impact Thesis. Today's guest is Ms. Ruchi, who is a PhD student at NTU. So, Ruchi, thank you so much for joining the High Impact Thesis podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Hello, everyone. I am a third-year PhD student at SPS, School of Biological Sciences, NTU. And my research focuses on understanding the epigenetic changes which are associated with cancer. So to explain this better, let me start with explaining what epigenetics is. So basically, all the DNA is made up of like almost 3 billion units, which are like tiny units of nucleotides. So it's quite long, and less than 2% of this DNA is actually coded into meaningful genes. So almost 98% of it was like earlier thought to be junk DNA and there was no use. That is what people used to think like 20 years before. But very recently, it was discovered that the rest of the 98% actually has a role to play. What this does is it regulates the other 2% of the DNA, which encodes for genes. And genes are responsible for almost everything that our cells are doing. So this regulation of genes is basically called epigenetics. So basically what epigenetic regulation does is it switches on and off these genes. So basically if you have a gene, so all the cells in your body have the same DNA. But definitely all the cells of your body don't look like, they're not same. They work very differently. Your skin cells are different from your eye cells, your brain cells, or like every other cell like that. So every cell of your body, although has the same DNA, they act differently. Why is it so? So this is how this question of epigenetics came into picture. So then people realize that, okay, there is some very strong regulation out there, which indeed turns on or off or controls these genes as to when and how they're supposed to be expressed. How much are they supposed to be expressed? So everything is very tightly regulated. And that regulation layer is called epigenetics. So like until a few years back, people used to think that cancer, which is like my disease model that I'm studying, that cancer is mainly a genetic disease, that we just inherit it and there's no other like many logical reason as to why someone gets a cancer. But then like few years back, it's very recent, like 5 years, I would say. So that's quite recent for at least scientific discoveries. So very recently, people realized that genetic biases have very little role to play. And there's a lot other factors that also contribute to how a cancer initiates or how it progresses. So it was then that epigenetic factors were studied better. And that is how we started studying epigenetics in cancer.
Oh, right. So we like to go easy on our audience at the very beginning.
I use too many jargons, is it?
but if I may summarize what you've said, it's the fact that there are two kinds. There is the control genes and the genes that code for something.
Yeah.
And these control genes kind of regulate and therefore determine what kind of cell it becomes or what function it has in the body. That's what you call it epigenetics.
Yeah. Also to add on to this, so there are actually different ways by which this epigenetic regulation can happen. So one way is that the rest of DNA, like 98% of the DNA is regulating. Then there are other factors also. The other factor is like the chromatin structure itself. So how the DNA is folded in your nucleus also is a kind of epigenetic regulation. And that is actually where my research area is. That is basically what my lab is working on, understanding how this long DNA, which is like 3 billion units long DNA, is folded into our nucleus, which is very small. And this folding is actually not random. It's not like it's randomly folded and squished inside. This folding actually has some role to play again. So if the folding changes, the meaning changes, the output changes. So we have seen that in like cancer cases, these folding perturbations happen. And when this folding happens, so what happens is two points in the DNA, which if you linearly look at it, they should be like far apart. But when you fold them, they come much closer and they start interacting with each other and hence start regulating each other. So these kinds of perturbations are very common in cancer. And this is one of the changes, like primarily that my lab is working on understanding.
So this folding, this folding can be initiated by chemicals and those kinds of things?
It can be initiated. It can be changed back also. But how a cancer cell, like how they do it and why they do it is still not known as to what has, but it can be modified back by chemical changes. There are drugs which can change these back to the way they were supposed to, but how cancers acquire it, what signals or what are the stimuli that is leading to these changes is yet not known.
Okay.
And just to clarify, what are chromatins and what are they?
Yeah, sorry.
If you can explain that,
Definitely. So basically, as I told you, that the DNA is very long and they're folded into compact structures in our nucleus called chromosomes. So we have 22 pairs of chromosomes, which we, pairs because we inherit one from each our parent. Okay, and then we also have another set, like 23rd pair, which is which are the sex chromosomes, which we have. Yeah, so these are the chromosomes are just like a structure in which the DNA is folded into. And so interactions within these chromosomes are chromatin interactions, which are the interactions that I was referring to.
In terms of coding, there are two layers. I suppose there's the layer where it's about the order of the base pairs, and there's a layer where it's about how it's folded. Is that the correct way to?
Actually, how it's folded is not coded in the DNA itself. It is the external stimuli or the environment of the DNA that determines how your chromatin would be folded. So, it can be very compactly folded, like it's like very tight. So now the DNA, which is very tightly folded, will not be available for any other process. Like you can imagine it like that. So these, all the genes which are very compactly folded will be turned off. They'll not express. They'll be shut down. Whereas the genes which are like loosely folded, a little open up, those will be expressed much higher. And these are the genes which are turned on. This is one mechanism as to which turning on and off of gene can be done by folding of DNA.
Okay.
So every time, like a gene, when a gene needs to be expressed somehow, the compact structure of the chromosome needs to be unpacked by a process first before you can do the.
Yes, actually, it is true. It has to be unpacked when so this kind of structures, these cold, closed and open structures, are not actually very frequently changed. So once your cell has determined its fate, like a cell will become a kidney cell. If it will become a kidney cell, the role is quite fixed. So now the because it will be doing the same thing. So the genes that have to be turned on or off at this particular time will be quite fixed for, you can say, the rest of the life of the cell. So it doesn't have to change that much.
So usually it's set early on in life, like in the development of the...
Correct.
I see.
So when they're differentiating from like the very first mother cell, which are called the stem cells. So when they're differentiating during those process, a lot of chromatin conformational changes happens. But once the fate of the cell is determined, these changes are not very frequent.
I see.
Ruchi, you have touched a bit on the kind of overall motivation of your work. Would you explain just a little bit for the people who are interested in the, why of it.
Sure, definitely. So as I told you, I'm in, like, my lab is working primarily on these interactions. So if we narrow it down more to what I am particularly doing, so what I am focusing on are these regulators called super enhancers. So what these are also DNA parts, like DNA elements, ATGC, like ATGC are the four nucleotides that form DNA. So these are also made up of these ATGC sequences. But what happens is when these super enhancers come closer to another part of the DNA, it not only switches this gene on, but it amplifies the output to like 4-5 folds. So if there's a cancer causing gene, if it comes near a super enhancer, the super enhancer will switch it on and the effect will become 5 times of what ideally it should be. So this is one very major, you can say, mechanism by which chromatin interaction can lead to cancer in normal cells. So I am primarily focusing and looking at how often this happens. And the model that I'm working on is leukemia, which is a blood cancer, and it's a very aggressive kind of cancer. So if I would dig a little deeper into the techniques that I use. So what I do is I try to map the entire chromatin genome, 3D genome of the cell. And then I see how often these super enhancer genes communicate with each other, how often they come closer. And if it's also there in normal cells, whether it's unique to my cancer cells, and if it's unique, whether we can change it back to the original form. So this is roughly what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm. So like a super enhancer gene would somehow upregulate another gene. How does that happen? Like physical contact, or you can give us a...
So what happens is, so a super enhancer gene is a gene which is very loosely packed. Like initially, as I told you, that compact packing and loose packing. So super enhancer gene region is that part which is very loosely packed. So now if a region which is very loosely packed will attract all the other molecules which are important for gene turning on, because it's so loosely packed. So it has some, you can say, binding domain sort of, wherein all these mediators or activator proteins and all these factors which turns a gene on will get attracted to.
I see.
And when it physically comes closer to a gene, it'll be very easy for it to transport all these factors, and then the gene turns on and on. Physically it works.
I see. So it's mediated by some chemicals that...
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there are proteins, like usually proteins, which turn on, and there's an entire process that happens. Once the gene is turned on, then again, there's a lot of downstream processes that happen for which you need a lot of factors, like these chemical factors, which are proteins. Yeah. Otherwise, like off the record, if I'm using too many jargons, just let me know, because words are pretty common, but it might not be that common for someone who's like not in biology. Yeah, so just let me know.
Yeah, no, it's okay, as long as we like help to clarify it should be
okay.
So in your work, in your line of work, then are you dealing more with the computational side of things, as in these chromatids and their interactions? You say you're modeling them. So do you model them, you go into the lab and try to put two chemicals together, or is it more you bring it into the mathematical realm?
So it's actually both. But when I talk about modeling, it's experimental modeling. So what we do is we actually kind of freeze the DNA where it is, chop it off, and sequence it. This is, like, to put it in a very like crude way, what we're doing experimentally is we just freeze our cell how it is. We'll just bind random ends, cut it, and sequence it. So if two points are closer, they'll be sequenced together. This is roughly the idea behind our experiments. But what happens is the data that we get from these kind of experiments is huge, which we cannot like manually process. So we do a lot of data, like for my project also, I do a lot of data analysis because to have some meaningful output of what we have actually done experimentally. So yeah, my work involves both bioinformatics as well as experimental part, but the bioinformatics is not like 3D modeling or something, it's just some data analysis.
Okay, so can you explain to mere mortals what, when you say cutting DNA, what is the actual, you know, because a lot of people haven't seen, I haven't seen DNA. I mean, seen pictures of it. I'm not sure what it looks like in a test tube, for example. So this cutting you're talking about, is it chemical cutting? Is it physical process? You go with some tools or what?
No, those are actually very small. We can't see it. Like, we don't see it either. These are like really small. But it's about chemical cutting. So actually, DNA is made up of two strands, which are in a helix structure. Okay, so what we do is there are some sites in the DNA which we know beforehand, which are called some restriction enzyme sites. Okay, so so these are the sites which can be recognized by the chemicals that we use, the restriction enzymes that we use, and the DNA will be chopped off at these sites. So that's how we just cut it. So there are other enzymes called ligases. Okay, so these ligases, they stitch DNA. So these are actually also present in our body, because when our body is doing any work, like maybe DNA replication or other processes, they also make use of these enzymes. Now, when we use this enzymes, we have synthetically prepared these enzymes, but it's just the same thing that our cells are also doing it. So it's not something very novel that we've come up with. It's just our cells are also doing it. We have also discovered how they do it, and we are just synthetically producing them and doing it to DNA.
All right.
All right. I think this gives a good introduction to your own field and what kind of work you are involved in. So now maybe we can move on and have a closer look at your own research work on a day-to-day basis. So if you can give us some idea what you do on a day-to-day basis, what kind of tools and methods you use to do your own research, and as well also what kind of objectives, research objectives you are targeting, and so if you can give us an idea.
So by day-to-day work, so the first part for me is to generate a lot of data as to like how, since I told you that I want to know what interactions are happening in cancer and how often those happen. So I need a lot of data to get some significant, meaningful result. So what we do is, so this experiment, so there are many chromatin capture experiments. They're called chromatin capture experiments. And what they do is they just capture the 3D organization of DNA. And the basic idea behind it is the same that I mentioned previously. We just freeze the DNA, cut it open, and sequence it. And we just know what two parts of the DNA are together and what are apart. So the very recent and you can say the most robust technique right now is HiC. It's a technique just called HiC, H-I-C, HiC. So in this, we just map the entire genome interactions. All the two points that are mapped, interacting with one another, are actually mapped. And we get a frequency also as to how often they're interacting. Because when we are doing some experiment, we use 5 million cells or 10 million cells. So now we'll be able to map out of the 10 million, how often we see this kind of interaction, a particular A to B interaction or a C to D interaction. So we also get that kind of a frequency. And then, so this is one thing that we do. We map all the interactions. The second thing that I also am is very important for my work is to figuring out where are these super enhancers? How do we locate them? Because it's not a very unique sequence. It's not like some ATGC pattern that this particular pattern means super enhancer. It is not like that. So for that, we have to figure out what parts of the chromatin or the chromosome are open, because these highly open parts are the areas where super enhancers are usually located. So that also we do using a technique called ChIP-seq, which is basically, So what ChIP-seq is basically we pull down parts of the DNA or sequence parts of the DNA, which are attached to a particular protein modification. Should I explain it more? was that too much?
Yeah, I guess that's
okay. So I'll add on a little bit more to this. So when the DNA is folded in our nucleus, it is wounded around a protein called histone. So it's around, so it will just coil around this histone protein. Okay, so for a protein to be open, this histone protein has to be acetylated. There's a tail attached to this histone protein. The structure is like that. It's a globular protein with a tail. Okay, so when this tail is acetylated, it's a marked acetyl group. So acetyl is a group's OH group. So acetyl is CH3CH2 group.
Oh, so it's attached to the tail.
So basically, an acetyl group is added to that tail because everything in the end is molecules and atoms.
Right.
So it's even the nucleotides, DNA is all molecules and atoms. Everything can be chemically, the molecular levels, we can just find all the chemicals, CH and everything. You can break it down. So these tails are then, if an acetyl group is added to this tail, this is a marker of open chromatin. Okay. So when we're finding super enhancers, what we do is we find, like, we develop antibodies against this acetylated histone. Okay. We have, we already have those antibodies. Like, it was developed long time back. So we might know, like, after this COVID situation, how antibodies and antigen work. They can, like, bind together and we can recognize them. So that's how we bind it to this acetylated histone and we pull down it. So every DNA which is attached to this region will also come out and we then sequence it. So that's how we know what regions are super enhancers. And then, for the later step, I then check if these are interacting with any interesting gene of my interest, maybe some oncogene, some cancer, like previously studied cancer causing genes. So this is roughly how this is the experimental model that I'm following. And as far as my hypothesis and the main objective is concerned, so I actually am more interested in digging deeper into the mechanistic aspect of it as to what drives this kind of interactions and how are these how do they recognize when to come closer, and basically the driving mechanism is what I'm more interested in and currently working on.
So the super enhancers are not a unique segment of DNA. It's unknown where they are. You wouldn't know.
No,
do they
exactly
behave that these are super enhancers.
Okay. They don't have a code. So it's for like every gene, we know a code. Like almost all the genes in our body are already coded. We know of every human, and it's actually very exciting. Like all the humans have very similar DNA. Like so, when we work, whenever we are like doing any analysis, we take a normal DNA. And that DNA was sequenced long time back by some lab out there. And we're using only that normal DNA as a reference for normal DNA. Although, like, definitely all humans have different DNA, right? But the differences are so small that we can neglect it. So
how do you know that you're... What if the base is not correct?
It's actually correct because so for a human to behave like normally, usually there are some housekeeping genes, or you can say some genes which have to be there for a human to normally exist. So if these genes are there, like mostly all these important genes are intact, then you can usually map them and call them a healthy DNA. And when we map it to a cancer gene, we usually see perturbations in these very important genes. And then we can say that, okay, now there's something majorly wrong and we need to check.
Yeah. Okay. But so I'm just wondering, in terms of what you define as normal gene, whose genes?
Normal genes is any healthy person. As long as, so for me, a normal would be a person who does not have cancer, because that is one like disease my project is concerned with. So if we know a person who does not have cancer is a normal person for me. I don't care about other, like the other medical conditions are not relevant to this particular problem. So that would be a healthy gene for our study, something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And for your own work, like what kind of chromosome or genome data you are relying on? Is it for humans or for mice or what?
So for my data, every work we do is on humans. So my lab is actually in near NUH, which is National University Hospital. So we actually get tumor data. So we actually get biopsy samples. So we get real patient biopsy tissues, which we process and then do our downstream experiments. So all the data that I'm collecting is majorly of human tissues only, real tumor tissues. But the experiments that I do are on cell lines. So cell lines are also human cell lines, but they are not from a patient taken directly. But initially also, so how cell lines develop is we actually take it from some human. It was taken long time back and we only cross-culture it. So we experimentally grow it in our labs. So that is a cell line. So all the experiments that we have to do, we do on cell lines because we don't get that many tissues, because there's so many experiments we have to carry out. So all the experiments we do are on the cell lines, but all the data that we collect, like the initial data on which we build our hypotheses on, are all human cancer data, patients. Mm-hmm.
So if I were to come to your lab tomorrow, would you be able to sequence my genes?
Actually,
my portion of genes that
I cannot.
Studying.
So all the sequencing happens. So we actually give, so all these sequencing happens using some very next-gen sequencing, very, very expensive devices called HiSeq or NovaSeq. So these are very expensive devices, which usually academic labs do not own. So what we do is we do all the processing, we prepare, extract DNA, do all the cutting, chopping, and get our sample, and we send it to sequencing companies. So there are very big biotech companies like Novagene, which does the sequencing for us, because we like, it's very difficult to own that sequencing machine. And even if we do, it's even more difficult to maintain it. So usually academic labs do not have these sequencing machines. So I cannot, but yeah, eventually I'll give you the results by sending it to the company.
Okay. Yeah. Now that's interesting, because I thought that if I read correctly, the cost of sequencing has gone down dramatically.
Yes, I
heard some people even say that you could buy the kit and do it at your own home. So
you can't
sequence it.
You can prepare libraries for sequencing it, but you can't sequence it. And especially the kind that we are doing. So there are also different kinds of sequencing. So if you sequence just a small part of the DNA, which is called Sanger sequencing, sometimes it's very tiny parts of, or sometimes you can do that for bacteria. They have a smaller DNA. So for those types. But if you want to do it for a human, which is so big, you can't sequence it at your home. You have to send it to these companies which are sequence it for you, but the cost is also not that much. So I think a normal sequencing for me would cost me $200, which is, I would say, not too much.
That's your full genome, or just the parts you're interested in?
The HiSeq that I told you, this one, the interacting one. But it is one of the most expensive sequencing that at least we do in our lab, because it's almost the whole genome we're sequencing. It's the entire genome interactions. Yeah, so it's not that. Even if you do, I think, whole genome sequencing, that is also possible. I don't think it'll be more than $500. So it's quite cheap as to how it started. Because the first time, I'll tell you this thing. So it's about in 2000, the first time a human genome was sequenced, whole human genome. It happened in 2000. And it was more than, like, many millions were put into this project. It was called the Human Genome Project. And so many millions went into, like, doing the sequencing. But now it has, so that the cost has cut down dramatically. And in fact, after human genome sequencing, only people realize that. So before that, people were under the impression that if we code the entire genome, all the problems will go away, because now we'll know how the gene has to be. But it did not happen, not at all. It, in fact, after that, people realized that it's very different. Like, even after, like, for cancer, if I tell you, like, if I'm not going off, too much off chart, but I'll tell you this story. So it's basically... Sure. Yeah, so before this human genome sequencing, so in cancer therapy, people had this impression that it's all because of mutations that are happening in our DNA that people get cancer. So mutation is basically a genetic code when it gets changed. So if instead of having an A, you get a G there.
That is no longer true, is it?
It is true, but it's not one of the main reasons. It accounts for, I would tell you, less than 10% of cases.
Oh, that's news. I really didn't know that. I thought that was the main story.
Exactly. That is true.
Same for me,
it is not. So people were thinking, like, if we figure out all the mutations in cancer, we'll cure cancer, because we'll know what drugs to, because once you know it, you can build drugs around it. Mm-hmm. So after this human genome project, they started sequencing all the mutations, and they found not hundreds, but literally thousands of mutations. And in fact, there's a catalog in which you can almost see 6 million mutations that are present in cancer, different kinds of cancer. So then they realized we cannot build drug around 6 million mutations. And so basically, this is not something we can target to cure cancer. And similar, so if like, and they could not even find common mutations in one cancer. So it's like you'll have, say, one said mutation in all kinds of breast cancers. They couldn't find something like that, not in case of colon cancer. And that is when they realized that mutation happens. It's quite often, like, commonly seen in cancer, but it might not be the main cause of it. So even if you develop a drug against that mutation, the cancer might mutate again to build resistance against the drug. And it might not be a very effective therapy that people were hoping in, like, early 2000. And then new approaches started, and that's how epigenetics and all these different immunotherapy and exciting drug discoveries and these things started. Yeah.
Interesting. So if I may ask, so for your work or what you're researching on right now, it has not yet come out of the lab to be applied. It is what you guys are working on, sort of.
Yes, that's true. It is not there in clinical trials or anywhere. It's still very basic work, and it's still in currently happening in labs. Yeah, but it's a very promising and new field. I think it is roughly 5 years old, so it'll take time before it'll mature and be like out there for clinical trials or something like that.
Okay.
I have another question. Regarding this point you mentioned. So you said that by knowing, by getting some information about the interaction between certain locations in the chromosome with perhaps the enhancers. Remind me again. Is it the enhancers? Right.
Yeah.
It might lead to cancer at some point.
Yeah.
So. How can that help in perhaps developing therapies, or how can it be helpful towards the fight against cancer?
Yeah, so basically there are chemicals again, which are known to, you can say, block these super enhancers. And so there are some chemicals which can, so I told you this acetyl group, right, which adds in histone. You can use some deacetylases. Then you can actually, to actually remove that acetyl group out there, then you can actually, like there are other chemicals also, like there's one BRD4, then there's another one, which is called THZ1, which you can use to actually shut down these super enhancers. So even if this interaction is happening, this extra and this additional expression of this manifold can be perturbed, and that will not happen. Yeah, but
I see.
Like, since we have come to this topic, I'd say, but another very important problem, or you would say question comes, is how to make it specific.
Yeah.
Because healthy cells also have these things. So that is a very, very big problem in cancer therapy, like in general, to making these things specific. So we are also working on it. But to be very honest, there's no concrete reason or solution to it as of now. But I think there are some drugs. There's one called Curaxin, which is very promising these days. It's not in clinical trial, but like academically and in research area, it's quite promising, because surprisingly it's only making these chromatin interactions only in cancer, but not in normal cells. Why? Even people don't know, but it's doing the job. So again, finding out why it's doing is something a lot of researchers are working on. But yeah, like developing cancer-specific drug is a very major area of research for cancer, because like obviously those cells are very similar to our normal cells, and it becomes very difficult to target them.
I see. All right.
Okay, Mohammed, if you have no more questions, we're going to move on to third segment of our discussion. The third segment is intended to be deeply philosophical. about your work. So we'll use the fact that you are doing things related to DNA as a basis for asking questions, but this is supposed to be speculative and to some degree, in a sense that what do you see beyond your field of research. So I wanted to ask a few questions, and to start is just when the cells have taken on a role, I suppose that when they have become a liver cell, is there a mechanism now to let them be another cell? Or at the beginning you did say that it's for life that they have chosen that career path, but I'm wondering whether there is a possibility in your readings, I realize not directly to do with cancer, but it's related in the sense that if you can revert them to be another cell, I guess you can convince any cell to be a good cell if it has started misbehaving. So I'm just wondering, are there advancements in that area where you try to move it to a different, to be a different?
So yes, actually there is. So this research is primarily comes under stem cell research work. So it is possible to actually, once a cell, when it has like drop down, and when it has chosen its path, you can actually push it back, like push it uphill, which is normally it'll never happen in your body. But right now there are researchers. These cells are called iPSCs, which are like induced pluripotent stem cells. So I'll explain this hierarchy a little better. So what happens is we have some stem cells in our body. Okay, these stem cells can become literally any cells. Okay, So they are like at the top of the hierarchy. Then they move a little lower and they become a little specialized in their work. Then even lower and very specialized. So this kind of a hierarchy is there. So there are some factors, again, protein called transcription factors, which were recognized. And this was, I think it was like a couple of years back. This was recognized by a scientist, and he recognized that these cells, if you add some kinds of transcription factor to these cells, they tend to move back in the hierarchy and they'll again start behaving like stem cells.
So the transcription factors are proteins,
like the ones that regulate your gene to say like on and off. Those are called transcription. So these are the transcription factors will tell your genes when to switch on and when to switch off. So if you add a particular set of transcription factors, in fact, in his research, I think he pointed out 4 transcription factors. So it's that simple. So if you add these particular transcription factors, they start behaving like stem cells. And this research is, again, very meaningful and helpful in case of, you can say, organ transplantation. So if it's possible, you can, like, if this becomes entirely, like, when it matures, this research, you can actually take someone's skin cell and make it a heart and give it back to the patient. It can have such meaningful implications. So because if you can turn something odd back in one direction, you can also find some transcription factors to move it to another particular direction. And this was actually happened. So in his research, he did not make a full grown heart, but he actually used skin cells and made it into beating cells, which are like the very preliminary heart cells. So he could do it. He figured out some things, but yeah, it's not yet very concrete work. There's so much more that has to be done. What side effects are going to happen? How long this works? There's so many things which have to be figured out, but it's a very innovative and like very exciting area. It'll be so cool.
So long term, I think I did read this somewhere. I'm not sure if it has already happened, but if you can grow a heart, then you probably can grow a liver, and you can and then you can grow the whole human, right?
Yes, yes.
from skin cells.
Yeah, you can. So it's very exciting. Like if you think about like this aspect, it's very exciting. You can just have so there'll be no organ acceptance failure, no immunity problem, nothing. All you need is someone's skin cell and just give them back whatever organ they want, and it'll solve so many problems. That's actually a very exciting area of research.
Cool. And I think the concern, I guess, that I attended some conference last year in Singapore that brought in people who did work to do with CRISPR, with the technology for cutting and then editing genes. And their concern was that it's cheap enough that someone can do it, can do some of these things at home, I guess. I guess to some degree, do you worry about, as a scientist, do you think about or worry about the fact that we laymen might be able to, you know, take this forward?
It is a little worrying. So I actually watched a documentary also on Netflix, which is about this genetic engineering, because CRISPR is actually that simple. We do CRISPR all the time in our lab, and it's very simple. It's like, for a layman, it's all about adding certain chemicals and just, you know, for how long you have to add whatever, and in the end you'll get the output that you want. But a person who is not very familiar with it may not know of the off-target effects, may not know how wrongly it can like really affect your body, because there are many off-target effects also of CRISPR, like all the time. That is what, like, academically also we are concerned with. Whenever we're designing a drug or therapy around CRISPR, we're off-target effects is one of the primary concerns for us. So yeah, it is a little threatening like that, because in that documentary also it showed like there are like multiple lines of thought apart a segment of people who believe that if there's a therapy out there which can cure anything, it should be freely available for everyone and not only a limited class of people should have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
But so if you think about it, this also sounds okay. But for me, I am more pro of not having it so easily available because people neglect a lot of all these precautionary steps, all the like dark side of it, the side effects and all the dark implications, and tend to do it if they think that it's going to help them. And like, it's now that people are using it for therapeutics. It can also be used for something as general as changing the color of my eyes. If you want like blue eyes, you'll just change to CRISPR and get your, you'll get blue eyes for your kids.
So that would be exciting.
But it'll be so reckless use of it. So it shouldn't happen. And then again, question will happen that maybe like if it becomes that important, then who will have it? Who will possess it? Then it might happen that the richer people of the society or the more powerful, you can say, the powerful people, they'll have more access to it and they can have their children in a certain way. However, others might not have access to it and they can't do it for their kids. So it's like building by, like it'll even further, exaggerate the disparity that we have right now in our society. So I am not in pro of having this easily available. And even if it is, it should be like very well monitored and within all the restrictions that it is currently. I think there's no CRISPR therapy as of now administered in clinics, but it might very soon happen. Yeah.
Okay. That's an interesting, an interesting angle. I mean, I think it's definitely, it requires, like you said, a bit of balance, right? Because at the end of the day, we want the discoveries that you as a researcher, discoveries to reach as many people as possible, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I think you feel better if you're able to save as many lives as possible. And I think if something is kept very private, we know someone somewhere is using it, you know.
Yeah.
it's just not me. It doesn't sound fair, right? So,
yeah.
So I think hopefully there will be some kind of balance so that the people that need it, wherever they are in the world, they should have access to these very advanced technologies, especially if they are affordable. I think my last somewhat on this segment is to do with the use of other alphabets in DNA. What I hear is, you know, we know about ATCG, right? ATCG.
Yeah.
But I've also read that in Japan, someone has Hachimoji that uses 8 letters as the building blocks. I'm wondering whether that's a thing that's talked about, whether it has any meaningful uses currently or in the future.
So I am actually, I am not familiar with 8 units as of now, but there's one thing called methylation of DNA. So as I told you, histones can have acetyl groups attached to it. DNAs can have methyl group, CH3 group attached to it. And particularly C, out of the 8 GCs, Cs can attach to methyl group. And once that happens, that region of the DNA, if they're like set of Cs, which all are methylated, that set of DNA tends to switch off. So this is also a kind of epigenetic regulation that is very common in cells, happens in healthy cells also. And there have been many publications in which they've shown that this kind of regulation gets altered in cancer. So this is a kind of modification in APGC that can be seen, but I'm not familiar with any other kind.
Oh, right. All right. I think this is the very, very research oriented, conversation.
Yeah.
So I think we would like to move on to something else. Mohammed?
Yeah, sure. All right. So now as we're heading towards the end of the episode, so we would like to stray away a bit from the research talk and all of that. And maybe perhaps if you can share with us now some of your other interests apart from your academic ones. So what kind of things or topics or hobbies or activities you like to do in your free time and you love to explore like in your free time? So if you can share with us some of that.
Yeah. So I think in my free time, I love dancing. I dance quite a lot. So when I was lived in NTU campus, I was a part of the graduate dance club. And now since I've moved out and I stay a little away from the campus, I actually go to some dance classes like during the weekends. So I continue to do that because that's like my, that's my relaxation hours. Yeah, I just have to do it. So I love dancing and I've been dancing since my childhood. So that's what I do other than PhD work. And surprisingly, usually PhD students are very, they like reading and all, but I surprisingly don't. I don't read that much. I only read like relevant things. I don't read novels or even I just read things which are very relevant to my work or I'm really interested in. I don't read quite a lot, but there's one book which is very exciting, which is which is about cancer, which I would recommend. I'll just tell you the name, which I'll recommend normally people to read. So it's not too much biology. So anyone can read it. It's about cancer. I'll tell you this book. Yeah. So The Cancer Code, A Revolutionary New Understanding of a Medical Mystery. So this is by Jason Fung, Dr. Jason Fung. It's a very exciting book and it will give you such amazing perspective as to how cancer research has developed over the years. So it started with people, as I told you, people still believe that cancer is a genetic disease, but it is not. Less than 10% of cancers account for genetics. Most of it is 35% of it happens because of smoking, which is, to be very honest, not that popular. People don't think, they're not very aware of it. This part is very, I would say, suspiciously not as obvious. Yeah, people don't talk about it. It's not, genetic biases are always there, but smoking and our food diet plays a very, very important role in cancer progression again. So these are things which are commonly neglected and people don't, I think because it's difficult to follow that people don't really notice. Yeah. And they're if it's there in my DNA, I'll have it. If it's not there, it's okay. There's nothing I can do about it, but it's not that true. So there are other things people can do. So it's a very nice read. It explains everything so much in very normal detail so that it's understandable to everyone. Even if you're not a biologist, you'll understand it. The entire evolution of cancer research. So yeah, that's a good book. So I don't read that much, but sometimes I do. And these are few of the, this is one of the books that I really loved reading.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. I mean, also we hope that listeners of the podcast will be one of the few who realize that it's not too much of, it's not too based on genes. It's based on things other than that. Obviously, some of these things also is just smoking is branded, in a certain way. So it's, people might know, but
yeah, exactly. Branding because actually there's a very big conspiracy theory of as to in 2007 when good research was published that smoking plays a very big role in cancer. There was this war against cancer, this group was formed, they were doing all these research. But then as soon as smoking and tobacco became one of the reasons, because of a lot of shareholders and a lot of powerful people were in position who were big stakeholders of tobacco industry, this entire war was shut and this all news was shut and no one, there are good articles about it as to how that was all pushed back and then genetic biases started coming up as to no, it's all genetics, don't worry, smoking is fine. But it's not true. It's very dangerous, as in that's one of the things that we at least recognize as of now. New things might come up with more research, but as of now we know that this obesity and I would say some things, our diet all play quite an essential role in cancer progression.
Mohammed, you have any other questions? No, all right. So Ruchi, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been very nice learning about DNA, learning about how there is more to just the included in the coding that we know about. There is also the fact that when you fold it, it either expresses itself or it doesn't. But also you've talked to us about how the regulation of expression of the genes is something that affects whether you have cancer or not, right?
Yeah.
And that there's genes, but also there is a lot that we can do as people to avoid cancer, for example. So thank you also for the speculation segment about what you think might be a good way to make sure that the research reaches people, while still being careful enough that it doesn't go into the wrong hands. So we really appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting.